All right. Hi, everybody. This is Doug with Emotional Fair Journey, and I am here this afternoon with Sarah. Sarah, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing great. How's it going?
Great. Oh, not too bad.
Awesome.
Not too bad at all. I think warm weather is finally here where I live, and hopefully it'll be here for quite a while. So it's good.
Same here.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you were able to join me today because we've been getting a lot of questions that have come in via email about the, from primarily betrayed spouses since we've been sending out these emails about the Empower Me program. And I wanted to get you on the horn here and kind of go over some of these questions maybe from the your perspective and, you know, that of many betrayed spouses. So picked out a few questions. Just want to roll through them and hopefully you're ready to go here.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I hear from betrayed folks after they discover their partner's had an affair is that they believe in their heart that their marriage has been a lie for the entire time that they've been married. The whole thing has just kind of blown up their entire perception of their marriage. So in light of that thought process, what would you say to a person who has that thought?
Okay. First of all, that is a very valid thought because at that point in time, when they found out about the affair, they're going to question absolutely everything about their marriage and they're going to start going backwards. And mm-hmm. as they go backwards, they're going to think, well, if he was able to lie to me, or if she was able to lie to me to have an affair, how much of the rest of my marriage was just one big lie?
Right.
Well, if we actually speak with wayward spouses, we find that the marriage wasn't one big lie. The big lie started when the affair started. And where does the affair start? Well, I generally say that an affair starts when it becomes an emotional affair, such as two people telling each other that they love each other, they wish they could be together, things of this nature, where mm-hmm. each person makes it very clear that they want to very intentionally be with the other person in a way that would break their marriage vows. So that's generally when the affair begins. And each affair is different, but that's really when the lie starts. And so up until that point, the marriage may not have been a lie. It may not have been a lie at all. And I know that that's hard to grasp when somebody's in the middle of what is probably the most painful experience of their lives.
Right, right. And I think from the wayward spouse perspective, they start to tell themselves those lies, you know, at whatever point in time. But the reason is basically quite simple. It's so that they can justify what they're doing in their own minds. And that kind of allows them to rewrite the story of their marriage and allows them to kind of, you know, lie about things and really become somebody that they're not. But so anyway, very good.
That is very true. And that's called cognitive yep. dissonance, if you want me to speak a little bit about that, about cognitive dissonance.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah, if you want to give us
okay.
a quick definition.
So that's, yeah, so that's basically,
for example.
Something that all human beings are capable of. And what it is it's when they are participating in an action or a thought process that they never would have done in their own mind because they see themselves as this great person who's a great family man, family woman, and all of a sudden they're lying. All of a sudden they're thinking about, oh my goodness, maybe I should leave my marriage, or just, oh my goodness, that person is so attractive. Well, if they have any insight whatsoever, they'll say, oh my goodness, I'm a good person and good people don't think those thoughts. And so they'll immediately look outward and they'll say, well, my spouse must have caused all of this, because if my spouse would have done the dishes or done the laundry or folded the socks right, or given me more attention, I wouldn't have had to do this. And that's where it starts. That's when they start lying to themselves so that they can maintain the persona of being a good person while still mm-hmm. engaging in some level of an affair with another person.
Yeah. So absolutely. Yeah. Great explanation. Thank you. Now, kind of go along the same vein here of my previous question, and I know that this is a tough one, and should a betrayed spouse take the affair personally? That's kind of a loaded question, I guess, but should they?
No. Of course, the first thing a betrayed spouse will do is take the affair personally. That's absolutely what they will do. And in fact, sometimes their wayward spouse will encourage taking the affair personally on the part of
the same as being blamed? Is that the same as blaming them?
Well, yeah, it's a type of blame shifting. So if the betrayed spouse takes the affair personally, and if the wayward spouse sees that, they'll say, oh, here's a great opportunity to blame shift. Okay, great. My spouse is giving me excuses. Great, they're even going along with it. So they will start maybe picking apart their betrayed spouse as a way to mm-hmm. make themselves feel better. But is it personal? Absolutely not. It has to do with the thought processes and decisions within a wayward spouse themselves. It's a journey of 1,000 steps. A wayward mm-hmm. spouse has to decide at each point, do I want to go forward or do I want to stop? And they can stop at any point, but sometimes they feel so compelled and drawn to another person that they simply just don't stop. Even though they know it's wrong, they just don't stop. And there are a million reasons why, but that would take another 3 hours to discuss.
Right. So in your opinion, So in your opinion, when a unfaithful person says, oh, it was never about you, I mean, can you kind of take them for their word then?
Well, yes, you can. Mm-hmm. Now, they may be saying that as a way to not talk about the affair. Now, their intentions may be wrong when they say that, but it actually is true because something in them decided to go down the path of whatever their affair is. They decided not to stop that path once they went on it. And no one can cause another person to have an affair. Even if a marriage is quite literally in shambles, I've seen many couples who cling together to try to work it out. We have some statistics that show that people who cheat say that at the time they are in very good marriages. And that's a paradox, right? Why would you cheat?
Sure.
If you're in a good marriage and if you're happy with your spouse, well, it goes back to the idea that it's never about the betrayed spouse. That's why somebody who's happy in their marriage can cheat, because it's not about the betrayed spouse.
Gotcha.
And I know that sometimes betrayed spouses, for example, when I was betrayed, I would look for things that I did because it gave me a sense of control. It's like, okay, if I caused this in some way, then I can fix it and I can prevent it next time. And that will provide the illusion of control. And so sometimes people will want to take a self-inventory. Healthy self-inventories are fine, but please don't take them due to the affair because it's not real. It's not what caused the affair.
Yeah, certainly don't blame yourself. Absolutely.
No, never, never.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Let's see. Next question on the list. Why can a person who has an affair be so hurtful to their betrayed spouse when their betrayed spouse is in so much pain?
Okay. That goes back to the concept of shame. Everybody believes that shame is toxic. Sometimes I think it's toxic. Sometimes I think it's healthy. Something such as healthy shame could prevent somebody from, I don't know, having a base urge like, wanting to run through Central Park naked. If that thought came into somebody's mind, they would be like, oh my God, I would feel so ashamed of myself if I did that. And so it would stop them. And that's actually a good thing. Well, then there's toxic shame, which is shame that they shouldn't be feeling because it's not really their fault. However, what a wayward spouse will be feeling is healthy shame when their betrayed partner is in pain. That will bring out what's called healthy shame in the wayward spouse. Now, the wayward spouse will not tell you this is healthy shame, but they will be terribly ashamed of themselves. It's like being caught with your hand in the cookie jar when you're 5 years old. And mom says, I told you not to eat all 30 of those cookies because they were for the PTA bake sale. And the kid's like halfway through the cookie jar by that time. And a five-year-old is not going to be happy if he or she's caught by mom on the floor eating all those cookies, caught in the act. It's going to cause shame. Well, when we grow up, we still have shame. And so the shame that somebody feels when they see their betrayed partner in so much pain will take over, that they will feel very ashamed just because they see the pain of a betrayed spouse. Is that fair to the betrayed spouse? Absolutely not. But it will cause anger in somebody who is ashamed. Often anger is a secondary emotion. It's not a primary emotion. It usually starts with shame, and then people use anger to cover their shame.
So that hurtfulness that they're instilling on their partner is just an angry reaction to the shame that they feel for hurting them to begin with.
Exactly. It's a paradox, but that's exactly what it is. Yes.
Interesting. Okay. Awesome. I had never looked at it that way, but that's a great explanation. And kind of along the same lines then, why is it so hard for the unfaithful person to understand the point of view of the betrayed spouse when they're in this condition?
That's one of the questions that I always struggle with since I've been betrayed myself. Mm-hmm. And this is one that I was hoping you could shed a little bit of light on. Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I think it kind of depends on where they are at in the whole process. I mean, if they're in the middle of their affair, you know, it's not even, in a lot of cases that I see, it's almost impossible to understand the point of view of the betrayed spouse because they're in such a fog and they're so into their affair partner and you know, kind of acting in an addictive type of way. Now, later on, perhaps as, you know, since most affairs tend to end, as we get closer to that ending of the affair, they may start to understand a little bit of the depth of the pain that they've caused and you know, all the consequences there, you know, as a result. And then certainly in my case, you know, it took kind of a period of time after the affair ended, and I kind of, you know, got out of my funk and kind of figured myself out. And you know, with the help of Linda, I kind of got to the point where I was able to really empathize with what she had gone through and the pain she was experiencing. Although, you know, certainly when we were in it, when I saw that she was in pain, it affected me deeply, but I was so, you know, selfish, and I was in such a state where I could compartmentalize things, and I was still able to kind of, you know, carry on my affair at the same time.
Well, that's pretty much, I guess, what it is then. It's the ability to compartmentalize. And I would
that's
also
a big part
think
of
that,
it.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And it's hard for me as a betrayed even to think, okay, really, you can't understand what you've done. I mean, when I think of that person, it's just, it's hard to fathom, but I do know that people do compartmentalize affairs and other things that they're not supposed to do, that they know they are not supposed to do. If they're doing them, they will compartmentalize them so that it doesn't drip into their primary ego or core sense of self and start to disrupt. See what I mean? It doesn't trigger their conscience. So they're able to, if they compartmentalize that little conscience on their shoulder that says, hey, 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 this is wrong, they can kind of suppress that as long as they keep something deeply compartmentalized. Yeah. And it's so hard for betrayed. It really is.
Well, and I think you can even chunk it down to a real basic, simple level, and that is, you know, affairs are enjoyable. You know, mm-hmm. People have affairs because it makes them feel good. Okay, so sometimes it's that feel good overrides, you know, what might be happening in any other part of their life. You know, that's why some people I talk to can almost like completely ignore their children, you know, as if they, you know, they just don't even pay any attention to them while they're in their affairs, or they, you know, they just completely go off the deep end because they're just so head over heels involved with the feel-good drug that's involved with their affair partner.
Yes, that's true. And it makes me so very sad when I think of these situations. And in that case that you've described, it's like having an addict in the house. It's like having one member of the family who has access to cocaine, and no one else in the family has access to cocaine. So this person's off on their cocaine high all the time. They're in an altered state of mind. Nobody else is. And they're like, what the heck is going on here? What the heck?
Right.
They don't have access to
that. Who is this person?
Who is this person? And the person on the cocaine high will have no insight, because those types of drugs do change your neurochemistry when you're actually on them. They do. And you're not seen clearly. And an affair can make you feel so good due to the acceptance factor. All humans need to feel accepted and loved. That's a core need. That's not a, it's nice to have it. It's a core need for human beings to be loved and accepted. And quite often, an affair partner will love bomb their married target.
I
see it there, a lot of intentionality on the part of the affair partner quite often, especially if it's a female affair partner. There can be quite a bit of intentionality behind it.
Sure.
They quite often want to replace the wife. They may say, "Oh no, I just want fun. I don't want to leave my marriage. I just want fun." Well, that's a lie, and they know that a lot of men will fall for that lie. And meanwhile, they're in the background scheming, how can I get rid of this woman and her kids so that I can take their place? And if she's making that husband feel so good, he's not going to see it. He's not going to see that this person that he's having an affair with is trying to lay utter ruin to his family, and that's very sad.
Right. I often tell people that I talk to that it's rare that I talk to an unfaithful woman that was just in her affair for kicks and giggles. I mean, it was there was some end game in mind. And, you know, I know that's a generalization. It's not meant to be sexist or anything like that, but that's just the fact that from my experience of talking with people. And, you know, but that's a whole, I mean, we could talk about that for hours too. So, but
we could. And the male and female brain are different. I mean, scientists are studying now that our brains are very, very different. That's just a fact. That's not sexism or trying to repress women. Our brains are very different. Men have more gray matter. Women have more white matter. The white matter in their brain connects the two centers. And so they can kind of have more of a holistic brain that doesn't compartmentalize. A man has a brain that can compartmentalize, and our brains are very different. Our motives are very different. Women want to nest. They want to set up a house. They want to nest. And it's how they're created quite often. Whether that's politically correct or not, it's kind of in our DNA to be this way. So if a woman says, "Oh, I just want a friend with benefits," she may think that at first, but pretty soon that urge to make a home with somebody else is going to kick in. And for any listeners out there, no, I'm not conservative. I'm not what would be called conservative at all. I used to lead a feminist group in college. So I'm just reporting research.
Gotcha.
Just research findings. It's factual information. Yeah.
I understand. Okay, great. So with all this stuff that's going on and pain and hurt and craziness and everything else, how in the world can a betrayed spouse even begin to heal?
Okay. The first step starts with the intention to heal. It always starts with the intention to heal. At one point, somebody's going to wake up and they're going to say, I am so sick of being suicidal every day. I am so sick of not eating. I'm so sick of having 6 panic attacks a day. I'm so sick of insomnia. I'm so sick of jumping and startling and wanting to run away or freezing because I just feel catatonic. One day they're going to say, I'm sick of all this.
Right.
And then that's when they will want to heal. When that day comes, they need to find a process to heal that will actually remove the trauma that's in their brain because their brain has been affected by the trauma of the affair. And they need to start rewiring their brain, quite literally.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has
to do with
changing.
Sounds like quite a chore.
It is a chore. It is a chore, especially if you want to do it on your own.
Right, right. So one of the things that I've kind of learned, and maybe it's through talking with you over the years, is reframing things. And the technique called reframing. Can you, and I kind of feel that it might apply here a little bit. So I don't know. Can you explain maybe what that is and how it can be an important technique for healing?
Sure, sure. I like to talk about reframing in terms of a picture frame itself. Let's say that you have a beautiful, ornate picture frame and somebody comes and trashes it with spray paint. You can take that frame off and you can go pick another beautiful frame and put that around your life. But from a psychology perspective, it's stepping back from whatever issue that you are dealing with and trying to ask yourself if what your perceptions are the truth of the matter. For example, if your husband's had an affair or if your wife has had an affair, you're going to feel worthless. That's one of the key components. You're going to feel worthless. And so here's where reframing comes in. In your mind, when you feel worthless, you're going to say, oh gosh, I'm just such a terrible human being. If I wasn't such a terrible human being, my spouse wouldn't have had to cheat in the first place. So if you apply reframing to that, you say, you know what? Actually, I've been reading the Emotional Affair Journey blog, and I found that I cannot cause somebody to cheat. It's an impossibility. It's something that they choose. And so I really don't have a reason to feel worthless because this was something that they chose of their own volition, and it does not reflect on my worth or value as a human being. That's what correct reframing looks like. It's not
awesome,
a type of denial.
Yeah,
right?
Well, that's a great example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a type of denial. Sometimes people get reframing mixed up with denial. Denial, you're putting your head in the sand. It's part of the 5 stages of grief. It's quite a normal process. It's something everybody will go through this once they go through the 5 stages of grief. That's denial. But reframing is totally different. It's just stepping back, looking at the facts, and then developing a new viewpoint based on those facts.
Yeah. Well, and I know from my own experience, Linda learned how to do that. And, you know, because I was, you know, throwing all kinds of crap her way, for lack of a better term, you know, and it wasn't really real. And she would reframe it, and she would kind of more or less say, hey, I'm not going to accept that what you're telling me is in fact the case. And, you know, that had a big impact on me as time went on. So I can see where, you know, not only is reframing a good thing for the betrayed person to do in their own mind and to their, you know, for their own benefit, but, you know, it can also go both ways.
It can. It's a great thing to witness. Basically, Linda was having you witness what it looks like when she's reframing something verbally.
Right.
And that's
right.
An excellent thing to do. And I tell you what, Linda is some kind of superhero, because for her to stumble upon that on her own, she's like a superhero, right? I mean,
yeah.
Really.
Well,
wow.
I'm sure she'd like for you to like for me to tell her that.
Yep. Well, so, you should, because I think she's a superhero.
I know. I tell her how strong she is all the time. But one other thing that is thrown around a lot out there, and I think there's a lot of confusion more than anything else, and that is this whole aspect of boundaries. You know, I talk to so many people that think they understand it's important for one to have boundaries with their unfaithful spouse, but you know, it's another thing to know what boundaries to set, how to set them, and how to enforce them. So can you give us some examples, maybe of some, what are some fair boundaries to set with your unfaithful spouse?
Sure, I'll do that. And just for anybody who's listening, if you hear a snoring in the background, that would be my dog. For anybody who has not been introduced to my rescue dog, he follows me everywhere, and he snores very loudly, especially during these interviews. So if you hear just a little purring in the background, that would be my dog.
So are you telling me these interviews are boring to your dog? I don't understand that.
Yeah, he might, you know, it's human speak. It's not bark. We're not bark,
okay.
Barking. And plus,
gotcha.
This dog speaks sea lion anyhow, so he likes to bark with the sea lions, not the other dogs. So boundaries. Boundaries are essential. And I found that a lot of people who are betrayed spouses have issues setting boundaries. It's not because they're the problem. It's how they were socialized. A lot of us have been socialized not to set boundaries. Don't rock the boat. Be nice. If you don't have something nice to say, don't say it at all. Keep your business to yourself. Don't talk about feelings. Others will judge you. Don't do this. Don't do that. And so there's this internal script. And things like that will cause us not to set boundaries with those around our lives. So what should a betrayed spouse do? Well, first of all, it depends on what kind of affair that their spouse has had. So if it's an emotional affair and it's just lots of emails and, you know, naughty pictures and lots of I love yous and, you know, you're my hero, on and on and on and on, the first thing that has to happen is, as always, a wayward spouse has to break it off. And they have to do it intentionally, and they usually have to do it with their wife on speakerphone, for example. They have to do it as a united front. Once that is done, a wayward spouse, well, actually a betrayed spouse, should probably collect those emails just in case he or she might need them, and then ask their wayward spouse to delete those emails. Then the wayward spouse must stop all contact with that person. And if it's their partner at work or whomever, there are a lot of corporate people who travel together all the time. They're always traveling overnight together. Really bad idea. They're going to probably want to ask for a transfer through HR. And they might even tell HR what's going on. I know that that's hard to do. But a betrayed woman will quite often lash out. I've seen it many times in my own life,
sure,
where there's been a consensual relationship. But once the other woman loses, she will go to HR, and she will quite frankly say that she was raped and that this is true. I've seen it happen. I've seen men be escorted out in handcuffs from corporate environments. Quite literally, white-collar corporate environment. So boundaries are so important, and they are all dependent on what type of affair that is going on. But the thing is, here's the most important key. Whatever type of line or boundary a betrayed spouse sets, he or she needs to figure out what the consequence will be if that boundary is broken, just like a child.
Yeah, and
right?
Stick to it. And stick to it.
You have to. It's just like a child, because somebody who has just broken off an affair, they're not going to be in their logical adult frame of mind. They're going to be, I want that thing that I was addicted to. I'm having withdrawal from my addiction, and I want that thing. And so somebody will need to be strong for them, unfortunately. And if that's a role you want to take as a betrayed spouse, you're going to have to set your boundary, and then you're going to have to communicate it, and then you're going to have to tell your wayward spouse what that consequence is if he or she breaks it. And then if he or she breaks the boundary, you have to carry it through. That's where it comes down. They will call your bluff. So you better make sure that it's a boundary that you can actually enforce, because if you can't enforce a boundary, don't set it. Just don't.
So is this the same as an ultimatum?
No. An ultimatum is more serious. An ultimatum is, I have divorce papers ready to go. This is just one example.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have any more contact with your affair partner, whether it's verbal or email or Skype or whatever the heck they used to communicate, I will be filing those divorce papers, and you will be moving out of my house. That's an ultimatum. Okay?
Okay.
A boundary is basically a set of rules that you have developed based on what type of affair your spouse has had.
Right.
And that has to be individual to each case. And that's where you should really bring a therapist in to figure out what's realistic for you and how to enforce it. What are you comfortable enforcing? Because if you can't, don't put the boundary down.
Yeah.
You can't.
Well, and sometimes it might be, right, and you might be in a position where, you know, you need to have a boundary. It's imperative that you do, but you either are not ready, or you can't think of one, or something like that, or having trouble. And it's okay just to say something like, you know, I refuse, you know, to put up with this type of behavior. I'm not sure how I'm going to handle it. I'm going to need to think about it, and kind of leave it at that. But at least you're telling them that, you know, what they're doing is unacceptable, and you're not going to put up with it anymore. You just need to think about it a little bit more. So, I mean, that's quite all right. I've heard people do that, and I think that works fine too.
It is. It is quite all right, especially if you're in the beginning stages, because your mind's scrambled. You really don't have any critical thinking skills at this point, because they've all been obliterated by the pain of an affair. And so it's very okay to say that. That's a great idea.
Okay, good. So, one thing that I really try to stress with people, and I know you do too, is the importance of the betrayed person taking care of themselves. And, you know, why is it so important for a betrayed spouse to have, you know, some self-compassion and really practice serious self-care?
Okay. Self-care is essential to mental health, whether or not we are betrayed or depressed or anxious. Self-care is essential to mental health, even for those who are not depressed. Those who are going or doing great, they're going to get burnt out unless they engage in self-care. But if you've been betrayed, self-care is a type of self-love that's showing that you are worthy. However, self-care also gives your brain a little bit of time to assimilate what has happened and start to process it. Our brains will start to subconsciously process an experience even when we're not aware of it. And self-care gives us the time to give our brain a break, quite literally, from processing everything.
Okay. So, let's just throw out maybe a few examples of some good self-care activities.
Okay. Meditation is essential. That's the number one self-care exercise, meditation. You can do it anywhere. You can go, even if you're at work, you can book a conference room and make sure it's empty, and you can participate in meditation there. The reason meditation, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and maybe you're going to get to this, but a lot of people think meditation requires you, you know, to set aside an hour and, you know, somewhere quiet or out in nature or something like that. You can meditate in 5 minutes or less.
And
this isn't something that needs to be, you know, something you need to schedule every day, you know, for an hour or anything like that. Continue on.
No. That's actually an excellent point. The only reason I was talking about conference rooms is because if somebody's working full time, they're going to say, well, I don't even have time to meditate. And it's like, yes, you do.
Right.
You can schedule 10 minutes in a conference room alone and you can start meditating. You can actually do what's called walking meditation, where you walk alone and you think about thoughts that calm your mind. Meditation is all about calming your mind. And meditation has been shown to rewire the brain. Mindfulness meditation very specifically has been found to not only rewire the brain, but yesterday I was reading that it's linked to anti-aging benefits in the body, quite literally. Yeah, I read that yesterday. Yeah,
okay.
And I think all of us would like 5 or 10 more years. I think we would all be okay with that. So,
kidding.
Yeah.
So what's another example of, give me one more self-care activity.
A bubble bath, even for men.
Okay.
I know that sounds silly, but warm water will physically cause your body to let go of stress because it's beautiful warm water, and your body will just start to relax. And if it relaxes, you'll let go of all that cortisol that you've been pumping out all day long. You'll give your adrenal glands a break, quite literally. And the reason I'm mentioning exercises like this is because one time we've gotten an email, and somebody gave us some very valuable feedback, which was she has a disability where she may not be able to do all the self-care exercises that people generally list on their websites. And I took that feedback to heart, so I'm trying to think of things that anybody can do anywhere, even if they're housebound with a disability. So I'm just trying to clarify that. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I agree. That's good. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I want to try to wrap things up here. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to mention, of course, is this program that you've worked on for over a year. We've called it Empower Me. And so what I want to do, if you could, is let's pretend we're in an elevator and we've got 30 seconds. And I ask you, Empower Me, huh? What's this program all about? What would you say?
Okay, what's this program all about? When a betrayed spouse has been betrayed, it doesn't matter how many years they have been married, they're going to be devastated. That devastation is going to cause trauma in their brain, and it's going to cause changes to their brain that could actually be seen on something like an MRI. Empower Me is about the science of what it takes to change the brain, prune back those neural networks that were built by trauma, and to prune those back and to create empowerment. And so I used research and built a program that could literally it will change your brain if you work through it and if you work through all the exercises. It's scientifically based because there's no point in writing a program that won't help somebody. We've got a lot of affair material out there. And so I would never spend valuable time on writing something unless it were truly new. And this is truly new. I've leveraged all the science that I've read on mindfulness meditation, on what it takes to change the brain, and I've created a 30-day program so that instead of people guessing, hey, how do I change my brain? I pretty much laid it out there in front of them. All they have to do is basically what I recommend each day. It's very easy. It's a great program. You can listen to it anywhere. You can read it anywhere. And if you want to start changing your brain and wiping out that trauma, that is why I wrote the program, quite literally.
Okay. Well, and I think also that in case some of the readers, or listeners, I'm sorry, don't realize it, you're doing it from also from the perspective of being an ex-betrayed person. So you've lived this, you've been through it, you've been affected with as a result greatly. And so this is basically something that helped you get through it when you were going through it. So,
yes, it's based on 17 years of research. Basically, what did I need when I was going through being betrayed all alone? They didn't have even good books back then because people were still blaming the betrayed. But this program is a one of a kind. Nobody else has done it. And it's based on what I would have needed if I could have gone back in time and handed a program to me in the past. That would have been the program.
Awesome. All right. I appreciate that. And I appreciate your time and all your hard work and effort. And hopefully everybody's been able to get some good information out of this quick discussion that we've had. And thank you very much. And you take care.
Sure. Yeah, and people are always welcome to email. We love questions. We don't bite. We always We don't bite.
Try not to. We love, right.
Yeah, we try not to. We love getting questions over the email. And of course, if anybody has questions about the product, we can tell them about that too. And so, I would also like to thank everybody who's listening for listening to us.
Absolutely.
And for coming to the blog, because we do all of this work for you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again so much, Sarah.
Yeah, and you have a great day. Okay.
Thank you.